As we get ready for the Hilltop Pro-Am competition presented by Syndicate, we talked to one of the skiers that that really set the pace in the latter part of the 90s, early part of the 2000s. We talked to Jill Knutson next.
The expressed views of the guests on this podcast are theirs alone and not necessarily endorsed by the host, TWBC, or any associated sponsor. Conversations that are robust yet balanced, on point and to the point. You are listening to The Talk of Tournament Water Skiing. This is the TWBC Podcast. And now, here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
Well, greetings and salutations to one and all. I am the aforementioned Tony Lightfoot, and this is the return of the TWBC Podcast. I know it's been a while since I did one of these, but things have kind of got a little hectic after Caiaphas didn't do a podcast there, nor did I do a podcast for some of the other events, especially the Nationals, because things just got sideways and got a little bit busy. But we slow things down. We take a calm approach into the Hilltop Pro-Am competition presented by Syndicate. And one of my good friends from way, way back in the day is Jill Knutson. And we'll talk to her now. How are you doing there, Jill?
Oh, I'm great, Tony. It's just great to be here. We're super excited because the weather looks like it's going to be an actual warm weekend for the Pacific Northwest, where you never know, near the end of August it could easily be 50 and raining.
Yeah, and the weather could turn a little bit on a dime as well and go sideways in a hurry, but for my part, I've been here for the last couple of occasions. It's been a bit nippy, I would have to say. So this year I came in with an extra supply of long pants, an extra hoodie or two, and yet we're going to have 80s and 90s. I mean, what's up with that?
It's the Pacific Northwest, Tony. It's not predictable, but we're just so excited that we're gonna have a good tournament. We got good weather, and we're hoping to see some of the best skiers. So the girls competition is really there's gonna be, we got Regina, we got Whitney, we got Jamie Bull. So it's going to be just the best skiers up here, which,
yeah,
we're so excited. We've always had great skiers on the guys' side, but for the women, the past like 7 years, we haven't really gotten the pull. So I'm super excited.
Yeah, and I'm excited as well. I mean, having all the heavy hitters in both the women's and men's competition assemble here in what can only be described as like heaven on earth. If you ever aspire to be a slalomer and want to take it to the next level, this is the place to be, right?
It is the place to be. Yes, there is a couple of tournaments. There is a man-made water ski lake called Radar Lake that it just beats this out just a little bit, but this is a gorgeous site, and this is my hometown site, so I get spoiled every day.
And I mean, it's at that level. I mean, whenever you put that much resource into how the grass grows, I mean, most tournaments you wouldn't even contemplate walking around in bare feet. I mean, you'd have to put some Crocs or some flip flops on. But here, you're like floating on a cloud.
Yes, there's a lot of green, and Gordon puts a lot of pride in his grass. And a couple of weeks, we had a real hot spell, and boy, we had all the landscapers out here contemplating, like, how can we get this grass greener, and it's not going to be brown when the Hilltop Pro-Am comes around. So there was a lot of tension, a lot of anxiety a couple of weeks ago when we got this big heat spell.
as one would imagine. Okay, turning attention away from the site, away from the tournament a little bit, although we'll probably hit it a few more times before the end. What about you, Jill? One of the great thrills that I have coming into this event is meeting up with you again.
Aww.
You know, because I mean, you were one of the dominating stars in the latter portion of the 90s going into the 2000s, and then you decided, okay, I've done a bit, you know, then and took a hiatus. But
yes.
let's try and set the scene a little bit. I mean, what were some of your major accomplishments within tournament water ski slalom back in, I would say, let's start with the 1990s.
Oh, in the 90s. Let's see here. When I graduated from, let's say I started My first pro tournament was at Soda Lake when I was 17 years old. So I competed against Camille Duvall, Dina Mapple, Helena Shaylander when I was 17 years old.
Wow.
Jennifer Leachman.
Yes, back in those days.
Gotta say the right names here. Yes. And they were just my mentors. So that was early, like 89. When I skied against those guys and terrified to ski against those guys on the dock. And then I went to college and I tried to get a few pro tournaments under my belt when I was in college. And then once I, 94, I came and got to be a part of the Budweiser water ski tour.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was just such a neat experience in qualifying for the finals my first year on the Budweiser water ski tour. So it was, so I got to just, there's a lot of history because when I started and how I've been able to practice. My parents moved from Colorado. They moved to a lake called Chulioda Lake, and Wade Cox happened to live on that lake, and Jared and Craig Llewellyn.
Yeah, I skied that lake a couple of times.
Yep, Horseshoe Lake, yep.
Yeah.
And so I got to ski with Wade Cox, and then and I also went over to Carl Roberge. Chris Parrish was right in the area. Ronnie Barton was right in the area.
All in that Oviedo area.
Oh, all in the Oviedo area, yes. So it was a great place to just, once I graduated from college, I got to come there and just take off. We got dogs.
Yes, indeed. A little bit of animal action back there in the background. But we'll continue on nonetheless, you know, because there were certainly plenty of distractions going on back in those days. You see what I did there.
Yes.
You know, so I mean, you skied in college. I mean, you were skiing on the pro tour and that kind of stuff. What was it like to handle all of the things that went on around you, you know? Because, I mean, to be successful on the Pro Tour, you had to have a certain focus and a certain ability to isolate yourself away from all of the noise, all of the distraction that went on with Pro Tour skiing at that time.
Yeah, it's funny because there is, it's a mental game. Water skiing is a lot of mental, and especially at like the Budweiser water ski tour, you have the music blaring and you have people on the shorelines that are partying and enjoying watching you skiing, and you have the distraction of other skiers, and you have the worries that maybe some of your competitors might want to step on your fin, and you know, you just never know what could happen. There is something about water skiing, and every site is different. You have different boats, you have different boat brands, you have different sites, you have different water, you have different temperature. There's so many variables in water skiing, and I ended up getting my master's degree. I felt like I was not so ill-equipped, so I ended up getting my master's degree after I graduated from college with an exercise science degree. I got my master's in sports psychology.
What was that college again?
I went to Western Washington University.
Western Washington, all the
and
way.
And then
over
I got
there.
My East. I went to Eastern Washington for my master's degree. And while I was on the pro tour, this is where a lot of my competitors thought I was trying to get an in. I was trying to get my dissertation and in sports psychology with water skiing, and so I was trying to prove a theory that all of us water skiers were. It was just a theory that the trick skiers were definitely type A. The slalom skiers were a lot of type A, type B. And then the jumpers were really laid back. And so I was just trying to figure out their sport psychology going into each of their sports. But a lot of what I found out was a lot of verbiage that I did anyways, just through the experience of trying to be a better water skier. And basically you have to tune out everything when you get on the water. You have to just kind of clear your mind, flush your thoughts when you're going around the turn island, and just focus on what you're good at, what you're working on at that particular moment, and be in the present when you're water skiing. So all of the noise that you hear on the sidelines, it just dissipates and you hear none of it. I've never heard any music, no matter how loud it's blaring when I'm on the water.
Okay, did you use headphones or anything like that, or listen to a little bit of what like was going on in the 90s?
Yes, music did help, but ultimately it's just... In the end, if you use that, I felt like it could be a crutch a little bit. And then if I use that all the time to get focused, then what if I lost it or, you know, didn't bring it one day? Then I would be out.
What if those AA batteries failed
right,
on you?
Right, yeah. So then ultimately it was just me just tuning out the noise and focusing on what I'm supposed to accomplish and what my goals are when I go out there. So that was my ultimate how I got to.
Now, a lot of people have... Whenever they're skiing in pro events and what have you, tend to focus upon high target goals, you know, whether it's going down 39.5 off of 35 or well, not so much 35 because that's supposed to be an automatic
yes.
for the girls these days.
Yes.
But I mean, in, you know, like getting through 39.5 off essentially is the thing that everyone aims to do. But back in those days in the tour, there were some horrible ski sites, weren't there?
Awful.
I mean, let's put aside Orlando Tour Stop. I mean, because typically that's the one that gets everyone going. You know, it's typically the top event. There are not too many rollers. You know, whether it'll be Lake Ivanhoe or whether it be Lake Eola, maybe not so much Lake Eola.
But it was in Pensacola. Do you remember that one? There was one like on the ocean.
Yeah, that was. Yeah,
yeah.
So
you got like salt water, and then you have the like surf, and it was awful.
And then there were river courses, like
oh,
in Chattanooga, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
I mean, where just running your first pass, you felt like a world champion.
Yes, you did. You throw the big fist in.
Yeah, I just made it.
Yes, for sure. No, and in the beginning, when I started in the Pro Tour, it was like the Budweiser Water Ski Tour. That was at like festivals, and so it was at big events, and they were just trying to pull. It was like at a lake that people could gather, and so we were just trying to get the main thing. It felt like from the sponsors' point of view, was that they wanted as many people as possible to watch the event because we didn't have any online technology. There wasn't anything online.
No social media, no YouTube, no nothing.
No nothing, yes. So it was just trying to get as many people to be fans of the sport as possible back then. So yes, there were some hideous sites.
What was the most hideous in your opinion?
Oh my gosh. Russia? That was hard. China, yes. I went to Ireland, Inniskillen. There was a tournament there in Inniskillen.
Yeah, Inniskillen, yeah, as part of the World Cup.
Mid-September. Inniskillen,
if
Ireland.
If you didn't bring a heater top with you,
there were people
luck.
In dry suits, Tony.
They were in dry suits at that time?
We were in dry suits.
I think I did. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that one.
Yes. Yeah, but no, it was just big sites. And anytime, like I said, there was one, there was a San Diego one that was, again, in the ocean, you know, in the bay. But it was just something about salt water that was so difficult to figure out. And you didn't get a practice ride. You just had to show up and just compete.
Yeah, just pull out and hopefully you didn't have too much speed going into your gates.
Yes.
And if you did, good luck.
Yes. The good news is that you didn't know where the judges were when you were out there, so you could kind of, you know, like maybe you might have missed that gate, or you just no one knew if you really made the gates or not when you're out there on the bay in San Diego or Pensacola.
Oh my word. And I mean, in a lot of those instances, I mean, the sites were pretty awful. But I mean, it drew some fairly good crowds in those events because
yeah.
I mean, they were tied into already existing events. Now, fast forward to today,
exactly.
You know, do you think the sport has lost a little bit from the demanded nature of events needing to have great conditions and great scores to be classified as successful?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Yeah. Transitioning, going through all the, we're like going back through decades here.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thought I think it's just so much fun to see it online and to see the amazing athletes and the just being able to have the camera in the boat. And because you never before, you would never get to watch these amazing skiers from the boat unless you went to Florida and happened to just, you know, feel like you won a lottery ticket and get to ride in the boat. When
sometimes you're kind of taking life into your own hands, because I mean, when Karl Roberge like loads up the line, or when Wade loads up the line and they decide, oh my rope's gonna malfunction, or I'm gonna pop the handle, bam.
Yes, for sure. For sure, you don't want to be in that boat when that happens. But yeah, no, I think it's really neat right now. And I think it's great to just see we're at the extreme stage where we're pushing the line of how short can the rope get and how we can still make it around those buoys. And is it physically the math part of it, you know, can we actually do it, and can we develop these skis to be able to do it, and the technology, the boats, it's definitely extreme. I mean, when I started, I'm going to age myself, there was a throttle. My husband had to learn how to hand drive, and we had a stopwatch, and that's how I started in the sport.
And some guy leaning over the boat.
Yes. So anyways, it's interesting for me to see when I started and what, you know, it took to for my husband to be able to make those times and in the guidelines that are provided with a throttle and no GPS and no technology. So yeah, it's been interesting to go through this.
Yeah, I mean, technology has had a profound impact upon the sport. I mean, so far as skis, so far as boats, yes, throttles, and what have you, you know, but all of that would pale into insignificance compared to how physically physically truly fit that the skiers have to be in order to take on these passes and expect to run it, right?
Right. No, it is. You don't see many overweight skiers in this sport. No, it is physically demanding. And I think that's why when I took a little bit of a hiatus, it was like, okay, now what am I going to do for exercise? Well, I'm going to go for a run, or I'm going to lift weights. And I'm like, this just isn't nearly as fun as water skiing. And if I can just go out there and water ski, that's my workout. It's not a real good cardio, but it's definitely a good workout on the body and an overall workout. And yeah, these guys are incredibly fit.
So when you entered your hiatus, which was
eight years ago.
Yep. So you...
Oh, sorry, let's see here. No, it was about... I've been coming to this tournament probably about 5 years. So 5 years ago, yeah. But I took an eight-year hiatus prior to that.
Yes. So like 13 years ago.
Yes.
I know. Yeah, my math isn't too strong, but yep, then I can at least... But anyway... So you took that hiatus, and you went pretty much open water skiing at that point, you know, just for fitness, having successfully taught your husband how to manage the throttle and all of that stuff.
Exactly.
I bet he felt the pressure coming off his shoulders, because now he wasn't so worried about keeping it situated in the course. All he has to do, yep, she's left, she's right, she's left, she's right. Do this about 20 more times, pull out, yep, give her a breast.
Yes, yes, for sure. I think what happened was my hiatus came down to you're in the pro tournament. Okay, I have a story for you. I was going up to Abbotsford, and Whitney McClintock was staying at my house, and I told her I would give her a place to stay, and then we used my car and we headed up to Canada, and she gave me her ID across when we got into Canada.
Oh wow.
And I looked at her ID and I said, "You were born the same year I graduated from high school." And I just I was like, I can't believe I'm competing against someone that's 18 years younger than me. And I adore Whitney, and we've had a great time, but there was just something in my head was like, I'm competing against someone. Like, I can't
this
be
is what it's come
level.
Down to.
This is what it's come down to. And so there was that instance where in my mind I was like, what am I doing this for? And do I really love it? And that's what it came down to for me. It was like, it became a job. It became your kids, my kids. I have three kids. So I had three kids while I was a professional skier for 22 years. And you get to this place where you just feel like you're doing this for selfish reasons. And my kids started to need me, and they're getting into their own sports. And my daughter was a really good little soccer player. And so you just get to this place where you're like, my husband needs me. He's a coach. He can't get the kids to practice. I'm relying on other people. I need to be a part of my family. And so there was just that hiatus. And I got to this point where I'm like, it feels selfish. I'm not loving it. It's the right time to stop.
So you morphed into the soccer mom.
I did morph into the soccer mom for sure, Tony. And I wanted to give my daughter, my parents gave me this sport. So they seriously moved from Colorado, and they moved to a lake on Chuliota Lake, or Horseshoe Lake in Chuliota, for me when I was 16 years old. So I felt like I needed to give back to my kids because my parents did the same thing for me. So it was that respect as well. And I wanted my daughter to pursue her sport in soccer as far as she wanted to go, because my parents did the same thing for me with water skiing. So,
okay. So now that the kids have pretty much done with their sports, you know, soccer or yeah. whatever sports were they involved in, the other two. I mean, you mentioned yes. your daughter.
My daughter was soccer and basketball, and she did pole vault. But soccer was her main sport. She was trying to get a scholarship for that. My oldest son was soccer, and then I have a younger son that's both soccer and he's a wrestler. But then once my daughter didn't get that scholarship into college due to COVID, because she graduated 2021,
ooh.
It was a bad year. But once she released that, then she became a water skier. So she's been skiing since she's been four, but all of a sudden she's like, oh, I like your sport, Mom. I want to do this.
There you go. That's
it's been really a fun summer since COVID. Yeah.
Okay. So how's she doing now?
Yeah. She's running 34, 15 off and just enjoying it. And I'd bring Jamie Bull in the boat to have her coach, and she's like, Mom, this is just for fun. I don't need to coach. No, honey, it's fun when you have someone help you and get better.
Exactly, you know, because, I mean, the worst thing that can happen, even in soccer or track or what have you, the worst thing that can happen is to have your parents coach.
You know, because
you need that standoffishness. You need to have someone else's eyes taking a look at them, you know, to have a little bit of objectivity.
Yes, which I want to talk to you about this.
Me?
Yes.
Oh,
so
here we go.
This new field right now are all our pro skiers that have coached their kids. So we got Neely Ross.
Mm-hmm.
We got Russell Gay, Anna Gay.
Yeah.
Who else do we have? We have Rhonda Huso's kid.
Erica.
Erica, yeah. She's still... And, you know, you have all these
second generation pros.
But when I was in the pros, Andy Mapple's kids didn't ski.
No.
You know, Wade Cox, his kids didn't ski.
No.
You know, trying to go through all these old skiers that, you know, Christy's kids didn't ski. Helena's kids didn't ski. You know, all these pro skiers, their kids didn't ski back in the day. So it's an interesting concept.
It's worthy of a dissertation,
it
I
is.
Believe.
It is.
if you ever went back into college.
And parents coaching their kids and their kids like flourishing. I'm amazed by that too. Like Neely and Dorian. Like
Dorian Llewellyn, yes.
Yeah, Dorian Llewellyn, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so many of them now. I mean, you definitely touch upon an interesting subject to discuss.
Yeah.
Now, let's get back to a little bit of what you were doing. I mean, you're out open water skiing. So when did the epiphany strike you, like saying, okay, I'm not done with slalom. I want to get off this big old lake. I mean, hubby, you've done well. You've helped me stay fit. You kept the throttle moving in the right direction. But I'd want to darn well get back out there on the slalom course and see if I can't leverage my ability and whatever's left of my fitness into the pro ranks.
I got invited out by a friend of mine I did a clinic. I coached him, and he happened to buy this water ski lake out in Eastern Washington. in Othello. And he called me up out of the blue and he's like, Jill, I bought this water ski lake. I want you to come just enjoy it. I don't know what I'm doing with this water ski lake. I just really liked you and I liked your coaching. I'd love you to just come out and just bring your family and enjoy it. So I brought my family and I skied the course and we got to like just enjoy the heck out of just having a nice boat, having a course, having the lake all to ourselves. It wasn't work anymore. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I can actually enjoy this sport again. And it doesn't have to feel like work anymore. And I'm not making money from it. And so it was that release of like, I love this. I love this sport. I love this activity. I love the people. I miss my people. And then when I started coming back and going to this pro-am, it was like I got to, you know, Chris Parrish is still here. Will Asher is still skiing. So there was some old, there were my young and up and coming skiers that, you know, I was probably on the way out when they were up and coming, but it just was fun to just be in touch with them and I miss them so much. So yes.
How long did it take for you to get back into, into a kind of performance range that was close to what you were doing before you took the hiatus?
It was nothing at all. It just came back. My husband still is like, how did you do that? I don't know. I think a lot of it, Tony, has to do with, I attribute it to the technology. When I came back, I also got a new ski from Radar, and I immediately ran.
So what were you riding on before you took the hiatus? Because Radar hasn't been in the sport that long. Radar came about in
right at the end.
So yes. So
it would have been like 2013 or 12 or right around there, 2010.
So you left the sport originally in 1999, around about the time that you skied the Worlds in Rochetto, and you probably got a story about that as well.
Yes.
But
it was roughly around like 2013 is when I left. So I competed up to about that. So and then Radar started. I had a Radar ski. And then when I came back, then they were like, hey, try this newer one.
Okay.
Yes. And then it was like, the sun came out. It was, I could run 35 really easy. And it just wasn't a big deal anymore. And I'm like, how can I still run this when I'm this much older and I'm really not in that much shape? So, yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the technology.
Yes, and I mean, technology has come along in leaps and bounds, even in recent times, you know, zero off, and now we've got the boat path management system, you know, all that good stuff. One thing I didn't ask you about is what do you do for work these days? I mean, you graduated college, you became a professional water skier, but you still had to shop for groceries and all that kind of stuff, and they don't come cheap today. So what do you do work-wise?
For me, I just tried to just be still, my husband would definitely say, you're still a pro skier. You just think everything comes so easy to you. But no, I have enjoyed being a substitute. So I've been a substitute in our school district. My husband is a teacher.
What's your favorite subject?
PE.
There you go.
Yes. It's an organized
studies.
Chaos. Yeah, social studies, yeah. You're more heady than I am. Yes.
Oh, I don't know about all of that. I do not know about all of that. You flatter me.
So I've been a substitute for the past 10 years. And then when COVID hit, there wasn't any sub jobs open. So then I went back and reverted back to being a high school kid and was a Starbucks barista. And then after that, then I got my
main. Hang on a second. Just for a couple of moments.
Overqualified Starbucks barista.
I'm trying to picture myself walking into a Starbucks and ordering. What was the most convoluted drink order that you ever took?
Oh gosh, yeah. Oh yeah. There's lots of them. Yes, they specified all the syrups and all the half calves and the long shots and what have you. So yeah, no, there's lots of them. But what it was is I missed people, Tony. I'm a people person, and so I needed to see people. And COVID kind of hit, and I just needed to see people. So That was part of it. And now I am working for Alaska Airlines, and I'm a passenger service agent. So now I get to have unlimited standby flights, and I get to fly wherever I want to. And I work for
You're in the call center at the airport.
Yes, I work at the airport. We have a little bougie airport here in Everett, and it's only got three gates, and it's a privately owned airport with a leather Italian furniture and a nice lounge that gives you, you know, real plates and real food on the, if you go to the lounge and order food. So it's just been, it's been a really fun. So I've started that up, and it's been about 7 months. So it's just been really fun to have that job. So it's my little side job, and it gives my husband and I the ability to go and fly and see my friends. Like, I want to go see Chris Rossi. I want to see Nick Parsons. I want to, you know, go see people that I and still keep in touch. So that's my goal since I've,
and then when they all come here at Hilltop, I mean, that must be like divinity right there.
It is. Yes. I get everyone come here. So that's why I just enjoy this, and I enjoy seeing you, and just, I enjoy seeing my people. So, yes.
No worries. No worries at all. I'd certainly appreciate you with this, being a part of this podcast. And it was great to talk to you. I mean, you've probably got so many stories, but the one story that we talked about briefly when I was coaching you from the boat was about the whole deal with kilometers and miles an hour, you know, because they were wanting they're wanting to pull you into the course at like, what you discovered to be 36 miles an hour, right? During the practice for the world.
Yes. So one of my dear friends was Sarah Green at the time, and we were, I was my first international tournament, and it was at the world. So I was in Milan, Italy, and we come there, the U.S. kind of comes there as a group, and you have these certain times that you practice. And so I was practicing, but Sarah was there trying to get in with our practice session, and I didn't, it was all kilometers and the ropes were all meters, and they asked me what my speed was, and I'm like, I think it's 55. So then of course I asked my friend Sarah, who I thought I could trust, but you know, she just loves to joke around, and she's like, no, Jill, it's 58 kilometers that you need to go, and which meant 36 miles an hour. And I at least had the sense of like to question her, and was like, No, 55 is 34. So I ended up going at the right speed. But then I made sure that I asked someone else about the line length so that I'd get the meters right. But yeah, I was just a stupid American coming into an international tournament, not knowing meters and kilometers. And yes, and just the sheer joy. When I've done head-to-head competitions, like true head-to-head, we would spray each other. I mean, there would be some trash talking. And,
oh, those were the days.
Oh, so much fun. And it was always fun when you had like those head-to-head tournaments where those were the best times, where you had the head-to-heads with someone like Sarah that was your like dear friend that you could trash talk and try to get into each other's heads. And then there was the head-to-heads where you had someone super serious that wouldn't say a word, that wouldn't look at you, that wouldn't talk. And you're like, oh man, they're really serious about this sport.
Yeah.
That was something I think for the most part for the decades that I was able to be in. And I think my husband was always, keep your sense of humor, love what you do. And when the love isn't there anymore, it's time to get out.
Yeah.
And if you don't love what you do and you don't enjoy it anymore, then that's the time to get out. So,
And I mean, a lot of what you said there kind of translates a little bit into your aims and ambitions whenever you come to a tournament like here for Hilltop, where, there's Jamie Ball, there's Whitney McClin, Tocrini, there's
Regina Jaquist,
and all of those who have high expectations to take the win or at least a podium.
Yes.
But your aim in this competition is?
Just to be around the people that I love and just enjoy the sport. I'm not trying to win anything. And for me, I just want to do my best. So that's why I enjoy having people come in the boat and still coach. And I still want to get better, obviously. Mm-hmm. I still want to run a 38 in competition, which I haven't done since I've been a pro. So that's still my goal, is I still want to get there. And I still want to be in shape and impress these young ones that are still coming up. And, you know?
Indeed.
Yeah, be a role model.
All right, then. So we'll round off the podcast around about here. We thank you very, very much for being a participant in it. But is there anything you'd like to say in closing, you know, thanks all that to hubby and all that kind of stuff, you know, before we close this out?
Yeah, for sure. First of all, I just like to, yes, my husband has been a huge supporter of me.
What's his name, by the way?
Andy Knutson.
Andy Knutson.
Yep, Andy Knutson. He has been just, like, from the get-go, he supported me to be able to make this move back to when I graduated from college at Western Washington. He supported me to be a pro skier and go to Florida and be a pro skier. So right from the get-go, when we were just friends in college, he supported me to be a pro skier. And then he became a great boat driver with just the throttle. He supported me, drove me. He sent me to all these tournaments. He was the main. We did not, never, ever did we ever live off of my salary being a pro skier. I always was in the red or broke even throughout all of my tournaments. And and then I'd like to thank Gordon Skoog for supporting me as well, and for building this gorgeous lake, Hilltop Lake, and for just being a great driver and for supporting me as well. My three kids, Carson, Kelly, and Cohen. And that's about it. My in-laws.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, it takes a village, doesn't it?
Yes, it does take a village, yeah. All the boat drivers and all the coaches that I've had. So it's, yeah, those are the people that I have built. The reason why I have this longevity is those coaches. That I've been picky about my coaches, and I would advise all people when they come up through the sport, be picky about who coaches you and who you trust to coach you. So.
Excellent stuff. All right, then. That was Jill Knutson, and this was the latest edition of the TWBC podcast. And so until next time, it is ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC podcast.